From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, she's the Democrats' biggest hope in 2014 for a statewide election victory. But for many in Texas, Wendy Davis remains a mystery. We have a profile.
When I was 18 and expecting, I made a decision to have a beautiful child who I'm very proud to have raised.
Conservatives say they want eminent domain reform in Texas. Why didn't we get it in the last legislative session?
Well, that's the way it usually works in the legislature. Most bills don't pass.
And private citizens on the border are helping one of Mexico's most isolated indigenous groups. The Tarahumara is under threat from the same cartels causing havoc on the U.S.-Mexico border.
Come the army, come the federal police, but don't do nothing about this.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. With Republicans Greg Abbott and Tom Paulken already campaigning for governor, Texans want to know whether Democrat Wendy Davis will enter the race and challenge them. From Dallas-Fort Worth, KERA's Shelley Koffler talked to Davis and others about that decision.
Wendy Davis's abortion filibuster not only brought her national stardom, it raised the hopes of Texas Democrats, including Evan Odell.
We need heroes we can believe in. I think we'd be much better off with her than a Tea Party lawyer like Greg Abbott.
Last week, Odell joined a crowd of more than 1,000 at a women's rights rally in Fort Worth, where Davis spoke.
Our partisan leadership in charge does not respect the rights of all Texans to make critical decisions about themselves and their bodies.
That message hit home with Jennifer Graham, who likes the way Governor Davis sounds.
You know, I was a kid when Ann Richards was governor. I think we need another woman up there.
But it could be tough to sustain the enthusiasm until the election 16 months from now. And then there are the cold, hard political numbers, as Southern Methodist University's Cal Gilson points out.
The Republicans have had a very steady 8 to 12 to 16 point advantage. And the fact that she made a wonderful filibuster speech and is in a potentially at least an attractive candidate doesn't close a 15 point gap.
Still, in her Capitol office, looking elegant in pro-choice orange, the 50-year-old senator seems unfazed by Texas voting patterns.
I think instead people are going to be asking whether the leadership to date has been reflecting the things that they care about. Not whether a D represents them or an R represents them, but whether their values will be reflected by the person who's there.
Do you think a Democrat could win?
Oh, absolutely.
So what would help you decide whether this is the right time?
Determining whether there would be the ability to raise the funds that need to be raised is part of it. Determining whether the desires of Texans really is to see a new face in leadership in the state or not will be part of it.
Part of it might also be whether Davis is willing to have opponents examine and attack everything about her personal and professional life. In previous campaigns, opponents have accused her of conflicts of interest, something she's always denied. But SMU's Gilson says scrutiny in a governor's race goes way beyond that.
The opposition research people who are right now pulling all the issues related to Wendy Davis and seeing which one of them is likely to be detrimental to her, those people start throwing the kitchen sink at you. And for a candidate that's never experienced it, it can be overwhelming.
Davis's story is compelling. She's talked generally about being a single teenage mother and how that made the family planning issue important for her. She relied on Planned Parenthood for her health care. Now she's also faced with other extremely personal questions that may be on the voters' minds.
Did you ever personally consider an abortion? Would it ever have been something that you as a young woman would have thought about?
That is obviously a very deeply personal question. When I was 18 and expecting, I made a decision to have a beautiful child who I'm very proud to have raised. She's 30 years old now, and she's a tremendous joy in my life. What I had the opportunity to do from that point, though, was to have good decision-making about what I would do going forward. And again, accessing those services that were provided to me by that clinic on Henderson Street, and to prevent an unplanned pregnancy was something that I took advantage of, and I'm very pleased that I had that ability.
Monday, Davis released campaign reports showing she raised over $900,000 in donations during the final 2 weeks of June, most of it following her filibuster. It's a drop in the bucket compared to the $4.8 million Republican Greg Abbott says he raised during the same amount of time. But not bad for a state senator who was not well known outside her district until a month ago and now has Republicans wondering, maybe worrying, what she plans to do. Shelley Koffler, KERA News.
If Senator Wendy Davis decides to run for governor, it's likely that Texas Attorney General Greg Abbott will be her toughest opponent. He has a swelling campaign war chest with over $15 million, and he's got the support of the conservative wing of Texas, which he's won over the years as AG by fighting for their causes in the courts. Abbott is already campaigning hard in Texas. Here's a portion of his stump speech at a recent whistle stop in McAllen, Texas.
We always take on the tough fights, and that's what I've been doing for you as your Attorney General. So when the Ten Commandments monument on the Texas Capitol grounds came under attack, I defended that monument all the way to the United States Supreme Court, and we won, and that monument still stands today. When your Second Amendment rights and your other liberties came under assault, I defended them all the way to the United States Supreme Court, and we won once again. I've been such a defender of the liberty that causes people to come to this country in the first place that I have sued the Obama administration 27 times over the past 5 years. You know, I did not invent that phrase, "don't mess with Texas," but I have applied it more than anybody else. I've also fought to protect our children. I fought against human trafficking right here in the valley. I've put away child predators right here in the valley. And I've protected and defended the most innocent, the unborn children, right here across the state of Texas.
That was Texas Attorney General Greg Abbott, who's running for the Republican nomination for governor. This was recorded Monday in McAllen, which was the first campaign stop after formally announcing his candidacy for governor. The rush is on in the state of Texas as the drilling fields in the west and south of the state produce ever more oil and gas. Companies are scrambling for ways to bring it to market. Pipelines are the preferred method, but what happens if a landowner doesn't want a pipeline on their property? In that case, the company can claim the right to take the land simply by checking a box on a government form. Efforts to rein in that power have so far proven elusive. KUT's Mose Bouchel has produced a special report for State Impact Texas about the state of eminent domain in Texas and how it can mean continued uncertainty for landowners in Texas.
At Margaret O'Keefe's farm in East Texas in Jefferson County, they grow high-quality Bermuda grass, the kind horse owners pre-order a year in advance. It's so good. The fields are flat and vibrant light green, surrounded by woods of a darker, richer green. O'Keefe gave me a tour on a recent hot afternoon. With us in the car was her daughter, Katie, her neighbor, Jake White, and her dog, Buster.
Did he get in? Oh, my God. Well, the dog thinks he's human. What can I say? He's treated like a human, too.
The land has deep significance for the family. O'Keefe inherited it from her mother, who divided it among her 8 children.
I'm fixing to get on my mother's 25 acres. She used to call it Enchanted Valley. As you see, the trees are all around. And she used to call it Enchanted Valley. Sometimes it rains here, and it won't rain anywhere else. And sometimes it rains outside of here, and rain never touches here.
Her Enchanted Valley also lies in the path of the Crosstex NGL pipeline. That's a 130-mile, multi-million-dollar project to funnel a glut of natural gas liquids from Texas to processing plants in Louisiana.
Do you see that black pipe we're talking about?
I see the green one.
No, look out in the field. It goes all the way down that field.
Yeah, I see it.
Okay, that goes the whole length of his towards the back.
That same day, over a lunch of tamales at her cluttered kitchen table, she and her brother Dick O'Keefe told me how the pipeline came to her farm. It started when a man representing Crosstex knocked on the door, and that in itself was not a big surprise. Companies approach farmers in Texas about using their land all the time. As she had learned years ago, she told the man she didn't want anyone on her property until the company agreed to cover liability in case a worker got hurt.
And they just kind of ignored it and came on and surveyed the property regardless.
Upset, O'Keefe and her brother told Crosstex they didn't like the offer the company had made. Dick O'Keefe described what happened next.
They turned it over to lawyers, got a nice fat packet in the mail that said, we'll see you in court.
Crosstex had checked a box on a state government form, it's called a T4, declaring itself a common carrier. That's how companies get the right of eminent domain for pipelines. It means if the O'Keefes weren't going to sell the land, the company would take it anyway, paying a price determined by the courts. The O'Keefes could challenge Crosstex in court, but as Dick O'Keefe put it,
we as small landowners, we can't afford to fight this pipeline company.
So they settled with the company. Their story might have ended there, except a nearby landowner, a wealthy trial lawyer, decided he would challenge the company. At the county court, a judge ruled that Crosstex never had the right to take people's land in the first place. The Ninth District Appeals Court reaffirmed that ruling. More appeals may lie ahead, but for the time being, that means the pipeline that now runs under the O'Keefe's farm never had the right to be there in the first place.
They should have to demonstrate, the pipeline company should have to demonstrate that they have the right of eminent domain before they ever start beating the streets and handing out contracts, which they don't have to do. The threshold for them is extremely low.
Now, what Dick O'Keefe said there, sitting at the kitchen table at his sister's farmhouse, is almost exactly what the Texas Supreme Court ruled 2 years ago, and what state lawmakers have been saying ever since. Companies need to do more to prove they can take people's land. Checking a box on a form is not enough.
They were claiming and are claiming eminent domain, and it's real questionable as whether it is.
Even pipeline companies suggested that some kind of overhaul was necessary. Before this year's legislative session, all the key players, from landowners groups to oil and gas interests to environmentalists, were scrambling to influence legislation to change the eminent domain system. State Representative Renee Oliveira was one of a handful of lawmakers who filed bills.
I had believed that this was going to be certainly one of the top 10 issues of the session.
So why did efforts to overhaul eminent domain in Texas fail?
The players that became involved with this was the true or the epitome of the definition that politics makes for strange bedfellows, because there were just so many different people that were a part of this in terms of their interest.
That's Norman Garza. He worked on the issue for the Texas Farm Bureau, a group that ultimately rejected all of the bills that were filed. Hear from him and others about the fight over Texas property rights in the second part of this series.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Earlier this year, landowner groups, environmentalists, and oil and gas interests appeared to be approaching an agreement about eminent domain. That's the law in Texas that many have agreed needed to change. But efforts to overhaul property rights failed in this recent legislative session. We're going to continue our special report from State Impact Texas and KUT reporter Mose Bouchel.
Committee on Business and Industry will come to order. The clerk will please call the roll.
At the outset of this year's regular legislative session, lawmakers on both sides of the aisle filed a handful of bills to change how pipeline companies use eminent domain. Right now, a company that wants to lay a pipeline can check a box on a form declaring itself a common carrier. The idea is that it will provide its services for hire to transport oil and gas. It's that role, which some say makes it similar to a utility, that gives it the right to take land. But in Texas, there's no test to make sure the pipeline will act like a common carrier. The bills filed this year all proposed new processes to do just that. One bill, authored by Tryon Lewis, state representative from Odessa, found favor with pipeline companies. James Mann is a lobbyist for the Texas Pipeline Association.
From the pipeline's viewpoint, it allowed us to get a determination before we started down the construction path to make sure that we knew what the legal consequences were going to be early on in the process.
Lewis's bill began its life as a half-page piece of legislation that called for hearings to determine common carrier status at the state's oil and gas regulator, the Railroad Commission of Texas. By the time it was ready for a vote, the document was 5 pages, the product of an intense back and forth from key players.
We did some serious horse trading in terms of provisions that were in that bill.
Norman Garza is with the Texas Farm Bureau. It represents agricultural interests in Texas, many of them large landowners. He says late in those negotiations, the Farm Bureau decided to oppose the bill, which died on a point of order. Another bill by Representative Rene Oliveira found a bit more support from landowner groups, but he says was rejected by industry.
I would have tried to find common ground and solve the problem because it still needs to be solved.
By session's end, none of the bills had bridged that divide. The reason goes back to the role of the courts. As James Mann pointed out, pipelines want to ensure that they can't be sued by every landowner along a route. They want one determination to take land and then to carry on building pipelines.
No sane person wants serial litigation. Well, I take that back. Certainly, lawyers benefit.
But Billy Howe, also with the Texas Farm Bureau, says the right to challenge pipelines at the county courthouse is exactly the one thing his group will not give up.
They never came up with anything at the Railroad Commission that was better than the local courthouse for the affected landowners.
If the gap between the two didn't appear insurmountable already, the arrival of lobbying groups, including trial lawyers and tort reform groups, added to the impasse at the Capitol. Things became even more complicated when two powerful oil and gas families entered the fray.
The Bass family out of Fort Worth was a power player.
Again, James Mann.
It would be my guess, it's only my guess, that it was that particular group that managed to get the Judge Lewis's bill killed on a point of order.
The Bass family controls one of the country's largest privately held oil and gas companies. They're also large landholders and advocates for private property rights. Supporting common carrier pipelines was another family flush with oil and gas money, the Koch brothers, out of Wichita, Kansas. Tom Smitty Smith heads Texas Public Citizen.
So you had these two very large family interests, the pipeline-owning Koch brothers and the landowner and oil and gas company, Bass Brothers. Fighting each other over both issues of principle and probably a significant amount of money.
Members of both of these families are large donors to GOP politics, and Representative Oliveira says their difference of opinion mirrors a larger division among conservatives between those who want to strengthen the oil and gas industry and those who want robust private property rights.
So it was a very strange coalition of members that aligned on both sides, and I think that coalition is going to remain.
He says as both sides will not compromise, there's little hope for lawmakers to rewrite the rules of eminent domain. But even if lawmakers can't act, that doesn't mean the courts won't.
We have a hearing now in the appellate court, Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals in Texarkana on July the 30th. Well, we will again say we don't believe a Canadian corporation transporting a product made in Canada has the right to take a Texan's land.
That's Julia Trigg Crawford, a North Texas landowner whose legal battle against Canadian pipeline company TransCanada has made national headlines. In the third part of our series, hear how lawsuits like hers are changing the face of property rights in Texas.
There remains uncertainty in Texas over eminent domain rules, and that's creating growing tension between private landowners and the oil and pipeline industry. We're airing a special report produced by KUT's Mose Bouchel for the State Impact Texas Journalism Project. In the final installment of the series, we go back to where we started, a farm in East Texas, to learn how legal battles there may bring changes to eminent domain when lawmakers refuse to do so.
At the O'Keefe's farm, outside of Beaumont, I walked through the fields and took a few pictures of the Crosstex NGL pipeline being laid into the ground of a neighboring property. This is a project that had declared itself a common carrier, a pipeline with the right to claim private land. But after the pipeline was in the ground, a Beaumont judge found otherwise.
They just claim it, and it's up to the individual landowners to challenge them. That's where I think the state could do a better job of policing what the pipeline companies are doing.
For landowners like Dick O'Keefe, lawmakers' failure to create a system in which pipeline companies prove their right to claim land is frustrating, to say the very least. The pipeline industry was also upset by inaction at the legislature, but for different reasons. It wanted rules that freed it from the prospect of more landowner lawsuits. Others worry about the impact of inaction on the economy of Texas.
Because we're so dependent on oil and gas taxes and severance taxes and production taxes.
Rene Oliveda is a Democratic state representative who tried to find common ground between industry and landowner groups in the 2013 legislative session.
It's going to cost more and more money to build those pipelines, and we will see less pipelines being built.
But there are plenty of people who think that the status quo is better than any of the changes that were on the table. That's because of what those changes would have done to legal challenges against pipelines. Norman Garza is with the Texas Farm Bureau.
All of the bills brought them to Travis County Court following the government code there, as opposed to continuing through that litigation process that would have allowed for it to remain in whichever court of appeals in their local area would have had jurisdiction over the matter on its own.
It was that ability to fight pipelines at the, well, ground level that groups like the Farm Bureau were trying to protect. And as long as the status quo stands, it is in those lawsuits at local courts that eminent domain law in Texas continues to evolve. Which brings us back to that Crosstex pipeline.
Hello?
Hi, I was looking for Kent Sullivan.
You got him.
To learn what legal challenges to Crosstex and other pipelines mean for eminent domain, I called Kent Sullivan. He's served as a judge in appellate and district courts in Texas. He now heads up the energy team for the Sutherland Law Firm, which has supported programming on KUT. He says a recent ruling in favor of TransCanada's Keystone XL pipeline affirms something very basic. Texas trial courts do have the power to rule if a pipeline is a common carrier. That means if a pipeline company is challenged at court, it had better come to trial with evidence, not just a state form claiming it can take land.
Certainly the message to the pipelines has been that you've got to be better prepared and you have to have your ducks in a row when approaching this kind of litigation. And that, to some extent, was the message in the other case that you referenced, the Crosstex case.
But the Crosstex ruling went even further. The judge found the company was not a common carrier because it didn't prove it would make itself available for hire. The ruling also said the pipeline didn't qualify to claim private land because it would transport natural gas liquids. The state's Natural Resource Code specifies common carrier status for crude petroleum pipelines. A district court of appeals reaffirmed that ruling.
It's hard to say that it's a win for one group or another. I think marginally these might advance the interest of landowners a little somewhat over that of pipelines.
Crosstex didn't return calls for an interview, but many expect the company will appeal again. Meanwhile, other landowners and pipelines are facing off across the state. In North Texas, farmer Julia Trigg Crawford continues her fight against the Keystone XL pipeline.
We don't believe a Canadian corporation transporting a product made in Canada has the right to take a Texan's land.
Just this month, another landowner in Collin County, north of Dallas, filed suit against the Seaway pipeline. With all these cases, one thing becomes more and more likely, that the state Supreme Court will again weigh in on eminent domain law. Back at the O'Keefe's farm, Dick O'Keefe says whatever that ruling is, it probably won't have much bearing on his situation. The pipeline at their property is already in the ground.
Leases have already been signed. You know, the money's been dispersed. You know, it's kind of after the fact at this point. But it was with the threat of going to court that, they beat us over the heads with the threat to get us to settle up.
O'Keefe says he'd probably still be fighting the pipeline if only he didn't have to go to court to do it.
As the summer planting season begins, American and Mexican citizens are helping one of Mexico's most isolated indigenous groups, the Tarahumara of Chihuahua, as they face the twin challenges of poverty and corruption. Illegal loggers and violent criminal organizations steal their arable land and plunder the mountains. Lauren Madelon reports from the Sierra Madre of Mexico.
A tractor donated by a family from Texas tills a field 10 hours by road from the U.S.-Mexico border. Corn planting season has started in the Sierra. The Sierra Madre is home to Mexico's lushest pine forests and world-class ultra-long distance runners, renowned for running 100 miles or more at a time. But it's also here where you see Mexico's most plundered mountains. Carpets of broken stumps crown many, its most unrelenting drought, and some of the country's most barbaric violence.
Mommy!
We're at the home of Tarahumara Governor Palma. She represents 9 indigenous communities. They've seen many changes since NAFTA was passed in 1994, flooding the Mexican market with cheaper U.S.-grown crops. Subsistence farmers like the Tarahumara couldn't sell what they grew. Then came nearly 2 decades of drought. Add to the mix illegal loggers and drug traffickers, stealing land with bribes and bullets to grow marijuana destined for the U.S. The lawlessness translates into less and less arable land. Now Palma says help pledged during the Mexican election last summer hasn't materialized. The government said we'd get supplies of beans and corn. They said they'd help us with irrigation, but she says nothing's come. Beyond government indifference, she says fear haunts many parts of the Sierra. We're always waiting to see what's on the road because people steal from us, she says. We also don't plant the way we once did.
The narcos come here to take the ground, you know, the farms with tierras, and the Tarahumaras got scared.
That's the voice of a local farmer. He's not Tarahumara. We can't name him for security concerns. He says the local government apparatus, police, the military, politicians, are bought and paid for by the cartels.
Come the army, come the federal police, but don't do nothing about this. All the Tarahumara got hungry.
We arrive at a small plot of land. Tarahumara farmers, protected by another sympathetic farmer, are planting corn. The man explains how things work in the Sierra.
The narcotraficantes, them are using the Tarahumaras, the people, and them says, you have to work with us, you have to give me this many acres to grow the marijuana or grow the amapola.
The poppy seed, that's of course the plant that they make heroin and opium from.
Yeah, And then if the Tarahumaras don't do with the people narcotraficante says, then kill them.
A cornfield is readied with donated seeds and physical help from Americans and Mexicans in the U.S. Theirs is an irregular but ongoing effort by private citizens in Texas and Arizona to bring in seed and modern equipment to this struggling population. A 10-year-old Texan whose family came from here explains.
Each week they work, and they don't have enough money to buy food or have a shelter.
Despite poverty and threats, they remain faithful to their singular culture, a mosaic of Western religion and reverence for nature. There's now a campaign underway to sustain the indigenous language, Raramuri, which means light-footed one. Governor Palma says, in Raramuri, we really value our language. She translates that thought into Spanish.
Vale mucho nuestra lengua de nosotros, Tarahumara indígena.
Palma says hunger in the Sierra is both nutritional and cultural. Tarahumara are hungry in their stomachs, she says, and hungry to maintain a cultural identity that, despite severe stress, survives. I'm Lorne Madelon.
That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. We'd like to get your emails about the program. Send them to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also post your comments on our website at tpr.org. And that's where you'll find an archive of past Texas Matters programs to listen to. We're also available free on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.